Blog Talk Radio.
Prophecy Keepers Radio.
This is Jasagonie, Will Bluewater, a seventh great grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evenings and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. OCO, Ginalii, this is Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Well, folks, welcome to this installment of Prophecy Keepers Radio. This is Bluewater. And our guest is Don Jaime Perez. He is author of Traditional Pathways, A Pilgrim's Journey, which is available for $9.99. I just want to say that Don Jaime contacted me, I guess, a little over a year ago and offered to send me the book. And naturally, I was delighted, but I didn't get around to reading it for many months, and once I did, I realized that, you know, from the time of year and things that were going on in my life right then, it was the right time for me to read it, and I guess that was shortly before the time the Prophecy Keepers Radio was inaugurated. So without any further introduction, Don Jaime, welcome to the show.
Oh, good day to you.
Well, I understand you've been in Mexico, and to introduce you a little bit further, I guess, you know, you're a man of letters, you're also a political candidate. Are you still a candidate for mayor in El Paso?
No, I get involved in politics every often, every so often, because I think it's important that the native voice be heard, although I don't necessarily identify it as that. I think it's a much broader focus, but I think it's very important for people to be involved in the life of their community.
Well, who knows, maybe we'll be calling you Alcalde someday. but anyway, you've done translation work, I guess, for Don Humbug's men, and have associated with other elders. So let's just let you tell your story. I guess originally we were going to speak with you just before Cinco de Mayo, and technical problems ensued, and then we found out you were headed down to Mexico. So this was the right time for you to have your interview. So tell us what's been happening.
Well, I have just returned from Mexico City, where I met with a number of elders who are doing some excellent work in the states of Nayarit, which is a strongly Huicho area in Oaxaca, with the Mixtecos, and in Mexico City itself with the Nahua groups. And basically, it was a ceremony of consecration for what is described by them as kind of the new commitment or the new era that we're entering. I think the starting point of the discussion should really be that there are so many stories out there, so many voices out there that are trying to let people know that the wisdom of the ancients is a great deal more practical and a great deal more grounded than has been, I think, presented by Western perspectives. And oftentimes there's a frustration among the elders in the various Native communities that their words, their stories, their narratives, their life experiences are presented almost in a caricature, in a cartoonish fashion, and to fit into some preconceived mold of whoever it is that's telling the story. And so one of the things that they have very keen on, or who have a very strong interest in doing, is to tell their stories, and for those stories to be understood on their own terms, not retranslated to fit whatever mold the storyteller might want it to fit. And so part of this movement, I would say, of elders is what I just came back from in Mexico City, and it was a very simple ceremony. It was basically a commitment by some of the elders of these various communities to simply say to the world that they want to be listened to on their own terms. Now, what that means is that oftentimes the stories of creation, the stories of relationship to Mother Earth, the stories of their pilgrimages, the stories of their development as communities over time, are stories that are very practical, grounded stories. Oftentimes the way in which they tell the stories is through metaphor. And the metaphor then becomes the caricature by the time that it gets to the ears and eyes of the Western audience. That what they are seeing are caricatures. Oh, interestingly, I was listening to your previous interviewee, Mr. Mills, and he was describing some of the glyphs, some of the pictographs that are found in Giza and that are found in the Hopi and so on. Well, part of the work of Hunbad's men, which I respect a great deal, has been that kind of transcultural work. He did an analysis, a linguistic analysis of the Tibetan language, the Hopi language, and the Mayan language, and he found a very similar coincidence, if you will, of glyphs, of pictographs, in the pyramids in the Mayan area, and we're talking, of course, of Tikal in Uxmal, Kaba, Chichen Itza, and so on. And he finds that that same sort of coincidence. He also did a very interesting ethnographic study or research, and he found that there were artifacts of trade between the groups from as far north as the Vancouver area, where we know of obsidian and other instruments that were found, and all the way to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina and Chile. So the extent to which there was an exchange of ideas, of traditions, and of trade among the various ancient peoples was quite extensive, and the position, or I guess the viewpoint of Don Humbert's men, is that in fact that history has been erased from the Western consciousness, and part of his work is to bring that about. So I think that's, by way of introduction, what I have been working with over the last number of decades. My own work is in searching out or calling out the various various ways in which Native people think about the universe, the way that they see truth and knowledge, and the way they see their own place in the world. And what I have done, my own transcultural work, has been to visit communities from as far as Vancouver and the northeast of the United States into various communities in the northern part of Mexico, and then on down south to Oaxaca and Chiapas and those areas, is to find the links and the similarities in the way people think of themselves. And in the book that you referenced, I was my first attempt at recording some of these similarities. And the basic position of these groups is that the origin of, or the first consciousness, if you will, arises from the Chichimecaki. And the Chichimeca, basically what that means is earth people. The original consciousness, or the first organized consciousness of people in the Americas, is from the Chichimeca, which thought of themselves as basically arising from Mother Earth, and understanding and realizing that there is only one earth family. And if you look at today, the various ways in which the academic world approaches the way to think about the world, they divide the world into races and ethnicities. And what I find most interesting is that the Chichimeca, way back when, set forth this idea that there are no separations, that in fact we are one human family, and that if you take that as a point of departure, then you see that the kind of tribalist thinking which has been the curse of the modern era is basically an invention that comes along much later in this historical continuum. One of the, and I'm jumping these historical eras tremendously, but I do want to get this out. So in the modern day, these groups that are still existing today, because you got to remember that in Mexico you still have 30 million people that are still speaking the native languages, whether that's Maya, Huichol, Rarámuri, or Nahuatl. You still have people who are living still in the old cosmologies and with the old traditions. And one of their frustrations is that people want to categorize them in the way that I just did, as somehow separate from each other. But within their own elder communities, with their own elders' councils, they don't see that separation. They don't see themselves as different from each other. They see themselves as connected philosophically as one earth family. And part of the reason that this Hispanization of, you know, teaching all these communities Spanish, or in the case of the United States, teaching these communities English, these languages have really been transformed into very universal languages that have allowed these groups to, these various communities, I should say, to communicate with each other in more direct and profound ways. In the Western academic tradition, you've got people like Samuel Huntington, for example, who are pushing this agenda that the great divide of the future is a divide along ethnic lines. And in fact, one of his theses is that Hispanics are a threat to non-Hispanics in the United States, and that unless there is a strong push to control the growth of the Hispanic population, that you're going to have the kind of conflict that you see now between the Islamic community and the Christian community in Iraq and Syria and in other places. And so this agenda, this kind of Western academic agenda to continue to see people as different based on their ethnicity or based on their culture, is an agenda that's alive and well in the United States. Samuel Huntington is no slouch. I mean, he's a very, very well-respected professor of history at Harvard University. And there are any number of people that subscribe to his point of view. His one of his nemesis is a man by the name of Fukuyama, who has written The End of the World as We Know It. And basically his thesis is that we're headed toward a democracy, that the world itself is headed toward a democracy, because that is the end of history. I mean, that is kind of like the highest ideal of how people should relate to each other in the modern world, and he sees that going in the other direction to Huntington. The elders, in the meantime, are saying, okay, well, this is all very well and interesting, and you have these academics arguing with each other over whether, in fact, our destiny is democracy or whether our destiny is to be fighting each other because of our ethnic background or our culture. And they're kind of waiting for their opportunity to get into the mix and say, you know what, we need to go back to the origins. We need to go back to how our own people saw the world, which was a world of one family with many offshoots appearing in various parts of the globe, with everyone having something to contribute, something unique, something marvelous, something fantastic to contribute. And that in respecting that diversity, but tying that diversity to the fact that we're only one family, is something that needs to be said, and it's something that needs to be respected. It's something that needs to be put front and center in the consciousness of everyone, that whether you're native, non-native, African, Asian, and so on, that if we take that as a point of departure, it'll go a long way to creating the social structures that we need in order to create a more peaceful world.
Well, that goes along with what my teacher, John Red Hat, used to say. He said that diversity is the mark of the Creator. He says we are His garden, and all the different colors and shapes, and he says where there is diversity, he says the Creator is at work. Well, for the folks that want to follow along that are on the internet right now, Don Jaime's website is casajaguar.com, casajaguar.com. And our guest is a seventh level Jaguar priest, correct?
Yes, in the Mexican tradition, you have what they call houses. And my own background is from the Huicho community in the state of Durango, which is the north central area of Mexico. And I was brought to the United States fairly young, and consequently learning English. In that tradition, you have a strong tradition of houses, or what they call Caliways. Caliway is actually the root of the Caliway is Aztec, Cali meaning house, and Way meaning creator, the house of the creator. And the Caliways are the kind of cornerstones of the kind of religious tradition of the Huicho. And in the native communities in Mexico, and those are the ones that I'm most familiar with, I won't comment on others as much as those I know intimately, they are divided by houses, and each house will have kind of a division, a division of labor. And those that follow the healing path are considered to be within the House of Jaguar, and that's the seventh order. And the healers are members of the seventh order, and the initiations that one experiences and one goes through are then consistent with that of the healer path. And so I consider myself a healer first and foremost, and an educator or a teacher second.
Prophecy keeper, prophecy keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Okay, well, I'm aware of a prophecy that speaks about their return to the seat of the Jaguar. And I can understand now why there is there are parallel prophecies among Mormon people and other people that say that there will be a return to not only the there are prophecies of a physical return of people down to the area of Mexico for the purposes of learning or regrouping, and now you might want to comment on that.
I think that there's certain things that need to kind of be laid out for those of you, those of the audience that may not be too familiar with the native tradition of Mexico. The first is that there was a man who wrote a very interesting book on the geography of thought. The native tradition is very similar to the kind of Asian tradition in that time is considered circular. So when people say the return of the jaguar, it is in the consciousness of the native means that time is not linear. In other words, we do not move forward in time. In other words, you're at year 2000 and you think of the year 3000. It is not a going to, as you would in the Western thinking, but rather a returning to that place of consciousness. And so that's very important to understand. So a lot of people say, well, you know, you can't go back to the old days, and that's because in their thinking, they're thinking in a linear way. And they're saying, well, you know, how can you go back to the year 1000? But if you see time as circular, in other words, that you are at once in all time, that time is simply a measure of movement, then you are always in all times. And so when you return to a consciousness, what you are saying is that you become fully conscious of that way of thinking or of that time that you were referring to. So the return of the jaguar is at once a going back to the past, but it is also a reaching out to the future if you think of time as circular. So I think that's a very important point for people to understand in terms of the way that natives think versus what I call the Western kind of European way of thinking of time. The second thing is that movement is reason I called my book Traditional Ceremonial Pathways, A Pilgrim's Journey, is because in each and every community that you go to that's a native community, you will have any number of rituals that imply movement, going up a mountain, and fasting, and vision quests, and initiation ceremonies, and gatherings, and equinox and solstice ceremonies, and so on and so on and so on, because it is in the interacting physically of your own body with your own mind, and then of the interaction of the mind-body with everything that's around you in a tangible physical way, is the only way that your knowledge is going to grow as a human being and as a member of your own community. And this is evidenced in, of course, in the agricultural communities where everyone plants together, everyone harvests together, everyone takes make sure that everything works in the way that it's supposed to work, and all of the visual labor that happens. It's a physical event. So people do not live in their own minds, which is a little bit different than I think some other traditions that talk about meditation, that talk about going within, that focusing on a center point like yoga, Buddhism, and so on and so forth. That is understood in, I dare say, in the native tradition as a part of a process, but it is not complete until you come out of that internal space and interact with your environment. So consequently, what you find, and this is strange to many people in the Western tradition, is that they find all kinds of powwows and fiestas and pilgrimages and all kinds of activity constantly throughout the year. And in fact, Mexico, I think, has some to Europe that kind of a reputation. It's a never-ending party. And what they mean is there's always something happening, whether it's a coming of age or whether it's a naming ceremony or whether it's someone going off to find their connection with Mother Earth and so on and so forth. There's any number of physical activities that are codified, that are actually part of the life of the community. And the reason for that is because knowledge comes only through the interaction of mind-body with the environment. There is no separation.
So you can't go without until you go within.
And vice versa. It's only going without that you can know more of what's within. That's that interplay of the inner and the outer that has to happen in order for you to gain true knowledge in the way that the natives think about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are for people who are not really familiar with the natives, the concept of time or the way that we see time and or understand time and the interaction of the inner and the outer. Those are the two very, very important elements if you want to understand what's going on in Native communities. And the third, I think, element that's very important to understand is that the impact of the current technology, the fact that we're communicating through long distances and that you're communicating to a much broader audience through the internet and so on, that's an amazing sort of thing. Knowledge was transmitted Native communities from one person to another, to an elder, to an apprentice. That apprentice system is alive and well in Native communities. And one of the things that is most interesting is that the impact of mass communication, internet specifically, technology, is really having an impact in Native communities. And that's one of the adjustments that are having to be made. Because whereas in the old day, the information was transmitted over a space of 10 to 50 to 20 years, I mean, people would apprentice up to 20 years with an elder. Now, the information is so readily available that that is becoming shorter in the space of time. So now people can complete an apprenticeship program, for example, in 5 years. Or 6 years or 7 years. And so the elders are having to adjust to that because technology, but also by the market of ideas. There's so many ideas coming from so many places, and so many people have an opportunity of being creative and coming up with new ways of thinking of things. Our own science or knowledge base is growing so much and is so broad that Native communities are having to adjust to that. But in their mind, this is all good news, because what that means is that they now have the opportunity, someone who does not have a lot of resources, but who has a strong conviction of the heart of idea, can compete with those people who have a tremendous amount of resource, because what is of value is going to be whether the ideas are functional, whether the ideas are grounded, whether the ideas are useful to people in living their daily lives and of their own personal healing and of their own personal relationships with their families and their communities.
So common sense is what is the coin of the realm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I know my grandparents lived in a suburb of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and they kind of lived off on a little spur road in the National Military Park down around Vicksburg. But in order for me to get to the local store, which was run by a Chinese family, I had to walk through a very poor black neighborhood where they didn't have, they had running water, but they had, didn't have any plumbing, and just water in on the ground. And so you get some idea of the lifestyle there. But the thing, when I would sit down with these old black elders, the thing they kept pounding in my head was, look, son, we want you to remember, you've got book learning, but the thing that we value the most is common sense. And it just seems like every time I sat down with one of them, that was the message that they felt that I needed to hear, and
absolutely,
it's underlined, and I guess this is what everything is coming back around to, is, and I can understand that the elders are probably elated that somebody's finally listening after 500 years.
Absolutely. And one of the things that strikes me the most is, while you have all of these powerful, powerful Harvard academics, Berkeley academics, Princeton, Yale academics talking about the racial divides and the ethnic divides and the religious divides and so on and so forth, you sit down a black elder, you sit down a Hopi elder, you sit down an Aztec elder or a Mayan elder, a Tibetan Lama elder, and you observe them conversing, and they have the highest respect for each other. They are part of the same family. And it is only in, unfortunately, it is only in the Western academic tradition that you find this tremendous division of race. You know, one of the things that strikes me in American consciousness today is that there's a man by the name of Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is hated by many of the political groups in the black community, but one of the reasons he's hated is because he doesn't go with the program, their program. He basically says, okay, look, if I see something, I'm going to call a spade, and I'm going to say it the way I see it. And which is that, as you put it, the common sense coin of the realm. And he says, if we, he's of course talking to the American community, he says, if we continue to buy into this division that's pushed by the Western academic tradition along race and along religion and ethnicity, we are doing our own people a tremendous disservice. And that message reverberates in the Native communities in Mexico, because they're saying this exactly the same thing. When they raise the children and they teach them about life, they always go back to the original principle. We are all children of Mother Earth, and you must always respect other people and their beliefs. We have a mantra that we use I get involved in the teaching that I do. And it goes something like this. You start where you are with what you have, and you do the best you can. You believe strongly in yourself and your values, and you respect the right of others to believe differently. that is a capsule of common sense. It's a capsule that if you ask anyone, Tibetan or Hopi or Mayan or Nahuatl or Huicho, whatever, and you ask them what is their philosophy of life, and whatever words they use, they will generally go in that capsule. We have something to say, which is we are all children of Mother Earth. We must all come together as one family. And we also respect other people's right to believe differently. And that key of respecting other people's right to believe differently is a key that is not accepted by the Western tradition, which is why we're allowing American blood to be spilled in Iraq, and why we have no problem spilling blood in Iraq, because what's guiding that is not we're one family. What's guiding that are all number of interests having to do with revenge, having to do with we hate you because you're different from us, having to do with justifying that by saying, well, you hate us because we're different from you. But it's basically a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. If you start off from a point of departure in life of saying, there are other people out there that are different from me, then you're always going to find reasons to have conflict. But if you start off from a point of departure that everyone out there is my family, and we need to work through whatever differences we might have and respect each other's creativity and points of view, then you find ways in which you can work through problems, in which you can find peace in your relationships. And that, I think, is a very, very important message, and that is the message that anyway I bring, I try to express as strongly as I can, in the strongest terms and in the most loving way, is the message of the elders of the various communities that certainly that I'm involved in. And also to tell people that it's not enough to know this. Going back to this idea of what's within has to come outside and vice versa, it's not enough to know that we're one family, and it's not enough to be aware of the wisdom of the elders. You have to practice it. You have to get out there and do it. And whether that's in the political realm, whether that's in your family realm, or whether that's simply on a personal level through pilgrimages or fasting or vision quests, it's just feeding that idea within yourself, feeding that feeling of commonality with others and of being one family of Mother Earth, and of respecting our place, not only on global terms on the Earth, but also our place in the universe, is something that has to be done. We have to do it in our actions, in the way we use our words, in the way we interact with other people.
Do the elders feel that getting the message through to the Nordamericanos is key because of how much resources these people up here in North America are consuming, and the rate that they're consuming it? You know, the message is great, and it would work if everybody would just think about someone other than, you know, who lives next door. You know, and this has been a real leap for me. I was brought up in one of the most conservative Republican homes, but in a lot of ways, I'm a political conservative, and in a lot of ways, I was, I'm far to the left. And I guess this is what it comes down to, is that people need to choose what's best, not only for themselves, but for everyone. I used to think, because the word was going around, we can't fall for this, we're all interdependent and all this stuff, and this is all New Agey and it's communist and all this other kind of stuff. And it took me a few years to realize, hey, something's got to be done, or, Americans are going to eat this world up.
Well, it's interesting because there are some ironies here. Oftentimes, of course, I make it a point to read what's being said about Mexicans on here in the United States, and oftentimes there's this kind of arrogance, this kind of chauvinism about Mexicans and in the broader terms, natives and so on and so forth. And yet, when I'm in the native communities, it's the exact opposite.
Prophecy Keeper.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
They have the highest admiration and respect for the achievements of Americans. I've talked to any number of elders who say we find what the Americans have done so incredible and fantastic and so consistent. The ideals of the American government. In fact, something as simple that we take for granted, but Native Americans notice, that to set aside a day to give thanks to the Creator, thank you. Well, to set a day aside to give thanks to the Creator is the single most important thing that America has contributed to the world.
Canada also, they just picked a Tuesday. But so the United States fulfilled a Nostradamus prophecy by picking a Thursday holiday.
Right. Well, that respect is there. And then technically, they look at the principles and the goals of democratic theory, and they say that to allow people a standing to everyone, regardless of because it cuts across if anyone, black, Hispanic, whatever, can vote, women can vote, so on and so forth. It's just that democratizing of the idea that government should reflect everyone who lives within the boundaries of that system is another thing that they respect tremendously. So, there is no sense of hatred or chauvinism or whatever among the native people towards Americans. In fact, they have the highest respect. And so it's kind of sad when, on the other hand, when I listen to the English speakers, look down on the Mexicans seen through the prism of consumption as being poor and in labor and basically indispensable. And on the other hand, the natives admiring Americans so much.
That's the way the Cherokees looked at the wife when they first got here. We the Cherokees loved them, and then they turned around and did what they did. But that was an experience I guess we signed up for. But the South African blacks back during apartheid. They kept their mantra was, "Will the whites?" No, excuse me. Let me digress. Their mantra was, "Will we have turned from loving the whites when they turn from hating us?" And so the people in Mexico are still loving us up to this point. And I hope that goes on happening, because given the right set of circumstances, and any disaster here or there, and the people in Mexico, could end with the history with the United States and past wars, there could be real conflicts, and I certainly hope not.
My own sense is that I don't foresee that there be real conflict. I think the amount of mutual self-interest is so great between the nation of Mexico and the United States that I just don't see that happening. It's just that we have too much in common. Certainly, people who understand Mexico on its own terms, people like myself, and who understand America on its own terms, people like myself, are that bridge, because oftentimes in Mexico, I don't understand why the United States went to Iraq, and I give them a kind of a glimpse of the internal politics. They understand that there are different forces in the United States, different interest groups that have certain agenda. They know that it's not all Americans that believe this, that, or the other. And in the same way, when I speak to American audiences, I tell them, look, Mexico is an Indian country. And many people still do not understand that the great majority of Mexico is native, has native background. At least 35% of it is still native pure, who live in a native community. And then you have basically like a 10% that is Europhile or European in background and who dominate the country.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I think we're moving in a direction that is going to determine whether we're going to be successful in creating a better world. And in order to do that, we need to recover. And as I said, this isn't going back historically, but going forward to meeting our new place, the consciousness of the Jaguar, which is a consciousness of universality, which is a consciousness of everyone working together and recognizing each other as one family. That's basically the message, and it's a simple message, but it has tremendously powerful consequences.
Well, I just wish the movie makers up here would stop portraying, Mexicans as macho drug runners, because it makes me, my people, my Cherokee migrated back and forth between what is now the United States and Mexico at least two times. Our wampum belts are tied with Mexican seaweed. But when I think about crossing the border to go down to Coahuila, to visit the people that left here in 1721 and the place where Tecoya went down to and died, I'm a little bit afraid. I'm from up here. I don't know the language. And, the policia at the daytime, are they going to be the banditos at night? Am I going to be safe?
Well, Luardo, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand in the history of Mexico is that the government was set up in 1521 with the idea of simply raping the country. The government that first of all, let me take a step back. People need to understand there were about 70 million people that is estimated in this continent in late 1400s, early 1500s. And within a space of 25 years, that population went down to approximately 3 million people throughout the continent. And the reason for that was simple: smallpox.
Right.
The Western history books love to write about how this intrepid band, 10 Spaniards conquering millions of Indians. The truth of it is that the minute they landed, the smallpox virus started spreading so quickly and decimated the population so quickly that in a space of a blink of an eye, which is approximately about a year from the point that Cortez landed in Veracruz, basically you decimated 80% of the population.
Mm.
And so collection of gold, silver, and jewels that were in that in the countryside, and all of the internal organization, what was left of the internal organization of the Aztecs, was used exclusively to extract the wealth of the country. That continues to exist today. The government of Mexico, central government of Mexico, is a very, very centralized government whose sole purpose is to extract the wealth of its people. There's no secret. 300 families in Mexico control 90% of the country's wealth.
Also, the same thing going on down there is going on up here, basically.
Well, so when you go to Mexico and you say the policia is part of that institutional apparatus that keeps everyone under control. And the Catholic Church, you know, my grandparents were Catholic, so they were very, very from a philosophical standpoint, were very Christian, very oriented toward Jesus. Of course, to Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the most powerful icon in Mexico today. But everyone recognizes the role of the Church. And in my book, in one of the chapters, I describe the way that the Church has been complicit in the genocide of many of the native communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot, in some native communities today, you cannot name a child with an Indian name. You have to give them a, quote, Christian or European name, unquote. And so you have a process in which, today I'm not talking about 200 years ago, I'm talking about when I wrote this book, I had gone, that was about 3 years ago, so in the year 2000, you have in areas of Nayarit and Durango and Zacatecas, you've got the Church will not allow the naming of a native child, period. Until, in fact, it was so astonishing to me. I went to the community, see the baby, I asked, what's his name? It doesn't have a name. I go, what do you mean it doesn't have a name? How can it not have a name? No, it doesn't have a name. I don't understand. Please explain it to me. I'm not getting you. And they go, I'm sorry. It's just that we're not allowed to name the baby. The priest has to come and give the name, give a baby the Christian name, whatever that is, Jose or Juan or whatever. That's why the big joke in Mexico is everybody's either Maria, Jose, or Juan, or Jaime even. And so that's because those are the names given by the Church. It's kind of like a generic naming. And until the priest says that is its name, then we are not allowed to name it today. And so if you have this government on the one hand that's set up to basically extract the wealth of the country and to benefit those few families that control it, and then you have a religious apparatus whose only purpose in the native communities is to create a cultural genocide and make everybody European, Euro-Christian, then you have a sense of what the native peoples are facing. And so for natives to then learn Spanish and begin to kind of put their ideas into practice, they have to hide a lot of the forms and a lot of the philosophy under a Christian rubric. And to give you an example, when you participate in a Huichol ceremony, for example, you will see a lot of elements in what we call altars, the kind of way that I was referring to, but in Spanish they're called altars because the Church has altars. And so rather than referring it to a central place where you have sacred things, which is the Kali Way, of course you call it an altar. And in almost every altar, you will see a Christian cross. And many of the elders will, when they start their ceremony, they will pick up a Christian cross. And they will kiss it and venerate it and do all of those sorts of movements in the traditional way with a Christian cross. Because everyone who's observing is observing to see if, in fact, they are, quote, loyal to whoever the powers that be. And then once they've gone through the process of saying, you know, well, we've worked with the cross, we're doing all the sacred movements with the cross and so on, even some of the candles that are required or that the elders will ask for their ceremonies will be the wax candles, called cirios, that are found in the Catholic Church. So that if the priest arrives and says, okay, what are you guys doing here? Well, we're having a ceremony, and they'll see the cross, and they'll see the Lady of Guadalupe, and they'll see the church candles. go to some of these native ceremonies and they see all of these Christian icons, they get the mistaken notion that they've all converted. But this is the only way that the elders are able to transmit the cultural knowledge to the community, is by this overlay, Christian overlay. I'll give you one more example of that. There's another community that I had occasion to study very in depth, and they have a church. Never had a priest. The church is not considered as important enough to have a priest because they're a relatively small, numerically small community. So I visited the church, and when you walk in, you see all of the Christ, beating Christ, carrying the cross, you know, very, very kind of powerfully bloody Christian icons as you walk in, and so on and so forth. And so when the local elder realized that where we were coming from, that in fact we were working with the Native tradition, then he says, come with me. And he took us to the altar in front of the little church. There's an altar, of course, where the priest does the mass and so on. And they moved the table where the priest would officiate the mass. And under the table, there was this like hidden compartment. And there, you had all of the icons that represented the philosophy of that particular Native community. And so all of the Natives would come to the church and understand that when they were doing their worship for the purpose of the priest and for the purposes of the bishop, and so everybody could see that there was a Catholic program or the Christian program, then when those priests would leave, then they would pull out their candles and their icons and their elements, their staff, their feathers, all of those sorts of things, out of that hidden compartment, put it in the altar or the kaliway, and then they would have their singing and their dance and their rituals consistent with their true belief systems. So Mexico, being the most Catholic country in the world, you will have seen, and there's another chapter in my book where I talk about the visit of Pope John Paul. You get the impression everyone's Catholic and everyone's with a Christian program. But if you dig a little deeper, you find that while they respect Jesus and the Christian program, because out of their own nature, intrinsic nature, that you respect all other beliefs, still hidden within that worship, you will find that they are carrying those traditions that come from way back and will continue into the future.
Well, I'm glad to see that Hunab Ku is alive and well.
And thriving.
I'm glad to see it. You know, a lot of the same thing went on up here, you know, before the Native American Religious Freedom Act. You know, they did their ceremonies in secret. If they got caught, they went to jail, but they didn't care. And that really gratifies me to hear that.
It's thriving, and they're holding on to the tradition. But they're facing tremendous challenges. And I think one other thing that is worth saying, for those in your audience who may be not familiar, my intention in my book, which was my first attempt, I'm in the middle of the second book now with a great deal more detail, is to say that I'm not trying to put wings on anyone. I'm not saying that Native communities are free of all of the perversity that other human groups are guilty of. No, we have good and bad in everyone, and in many of the Native communities, certainly in the United States and in Mexico, alcoholism is a tremendous problem. Despair is a tremendous problem. Now increasingly drugs are a tremendous problem. And the reason is that you have an unraveling of that traditional system. I mean, think about it. If you are trying to educate your own family, you educate those that come after you, and you're having to hide the way you're educating them because your school system is teaching them something totally different. Your church is teaching them something totally different. The government is organized to brainwash you in a completely different way. The success of you being able to hold on to what you know and to keep your children protected is going to, it's going to have some problems. And there are some communities where, half of the population is in total despair. So this is not to suggest that Natives have some sort of, special gift of being angels, or to suggest there are no problems. The problems are many and severe. The only purpose of my work is to tell people, if you look closely enough at these communities, and if you listen to their elders,
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
They have the highest admiration and respect for the achievements of Americans. I've talked to any number of elders who say, "We find what the Americans have done so incredible and fantastic and so consistent. The ideals of the American government. In fact, something as simple that we take for granted, that Native Americans notice, is to set aside a day to give thanks to the Creator. Thank you. Well, to set a day aside to give thanks to the Creator is the single most important thing that America has contributed to the world."
Canada also, they just picked a Tuesday. But so the United States fulfilled a Nostradamus prophecy by picking a Thursday holiday.
Right. Well, that perspective there. And then technically, they look at the principles and the goals of democratic theory. And they say that to allow people a standing to everyone, regardless of, because it cuts across if anyone, black, Hispanic, whatever, can vote, women can vote, so on and so forth. It's just that democratizing of the idea that government should reflect everyone who lives within the boundaries of that system is another thing that they respect tremendously. So, there is no sense of hatred or chauvinism or whatever among the native people towards Americans. In fact, they have the highest respect. And so it's kind of sad when, on the other hand, when I listen to the English speakers, look down on the Mexicans as seen through the prism of consumption as being poor and in labor and basically dispensable. And on the other hand, the natives admiring Americans so much.
That's the way the Cherokees looked at the white when they first got here. We the Cherokees loved them, and then they turned around and did what they did. But that was an experience I guess we signed up for. But the South African blacks back during apartheid, they kept their mantra was, "Will the whites?" No, excuse me. Let me digress. Their mantra was, "Will we have turned from loving the whites when they turn from hating us?" And so So the people in Mexico are still loving us up to this point. And I hope that goes on happening because, given the right set of circumstances and, you know, any disaster here or there, and, you know, the people in Mexico, you know, could, and with the history with the United States and past wars, you know, there could be real conflicts, and I certainly hope not.
Well, my own sense is that I don't foresee that there be real conflict. I mean, the amount of mutual self-interest is so great between the nation of Mexico and the United States that I just don't see that happening. It's just that we have too much in common. Certainly, people who understand Mexico on its own terms, people like myself, and who understand America on its own terms, people like myself, are that bridge, because oftentimes when it comes to disaster, I don't understand why the United States is doing what it's doing in Iraq, and I give them a kind of a glimpse of the internal politics. They understand that there are different forces in the United States, different interest groups that have certain agenda. They know that it's not all Americans that believe this, that, or the other. And in the same way, when I speak to American audiences, I tell them, look, Mexico is an Indian country, and many people still do not understand that the great majority of Mexico is native, has native backgrounds. At least 35% of it is still native pure, who live in a native community. And then you have basically like a 10% that is Europhile or European in background and who dominate the country.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I think we're moving in a direction that is going to determine whether we're going to be successful in creating a better world. And in order to do that, we need to recover. And as I said, this isn't me going back historically, but going forward to meeting our new place, the consciousness of the Jaguar, which is the consciousness of universality, which is the consciousness of everyone working together and recognizing each other as one family. That's basically the message. It's a simple message, but it has tremendously powerful consequences.
Well, I just wish the movie makers up here would stop portraying, you know, Mexicans as macho drug runners, you know, because it makes me, you know, my people, my Cherokee migrated back and forth between what is now the United States and Mexico at least two times. Our wampum belts are tied with Mexican seaweed, but when I think about crossing the border to go down to Coahuila, you know, to visit the people that left here in 1721 and the place where Tikoya went down to and died, you know, I'm a little bit afraid. You know, I'm from up here. I don't know the language, and you know, the policia at the daytime, you know, are they going to be the bandidos at night? You know, am I going to be safe?
Well, Blue Water, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand the history of Mexico is that the government was set up in 1521 with the idea of simply raising the country. Government that turned all of them take a step back. People need to understand there were about 70 million people, it is estimated, in this continent in late 1400s, early 1500s. And within a space of 25 years, that population went down to approximately 3 million people throughout the continent. And the reason for that was simple: smallpox.
Right.
You know, the Western history books love to write about how this intrepid band of 10 Spaniards conquering millions of Indians. The truth of it is that the minute they landed, the smallpox virus started spreading so quickly and decimated the population so quickly that in a space of a blink of an eye, which is approximately about a year from the point that Cortez landed in Veracruz, basically you decimated 80% of the population.
Mm.
And so then they installed the government after they destroyed the Tenochtitlan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire at that point. They installed this government whose sole purpose was the collection of gold
also the same thing going on down there is going on up here, basically.
So when you go to Mexico and you say the policia is part of that institutional apparatus that keeps everyone under control. And the Catholic Church, you know, my grandparents were Catholic, so they were very, very from a philosophical standpoint, were very Christian, very oriented toward Jesus. Of course, to Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the most powerful icon in Mexico today. But everyone recognizes the role of the church. And in my book, in one of the chapters, I describe the ways the church has been complicit in the genocide of many of the native communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot, in some native communities today, you cannot name a child with an Indian name. You have to give them a, quote, Christian or European name.
Wow.
Unquote. And so you have a process in which church today, I'm not talking about 200 years ago, I'm talking about when I wrote this book, I had gone, that was about 3 years ago, so in the year 2000, you have in areas of Nayarit and Durango and Zacatecas, you've got the church will not allow the naming of a native child, period, until, in fact, it was so astonishing to me. I went to the community, see the baby, I asked, what's his name? It doesn't have a name. I go, what do you mean it doesn't have a name? How can it not have a name? No, it doesn't have a name. I don't understand. Please explain it to me. I'm not getting you. And they go, I'm sorry. It's just that we're not allowed to name the baby. The priest has to come and give the name, give a baby the Christian name, whatever that is, Jose or Juan or whatever. That's why it's a big joke in Mexico, because everybody's either Maria, Jose, or Juan, or Jaime even. And so that's because those are the names given by the church. It's kind of a generic naming. And until the priest says that is its name, then we are not allowed to name it today. And so if you have this government on the one hand that's set up to basically extract the wealth of the country and to benefit those few families that control it, and then you have a religious apparatus whose only purpose in the native communities is to create a cultural genocide and make everybody European, Euro-Christian, then you have a sense of what the native peoples are facing. And so for natives to then learn Spanish and begin to kind of put their ideas into practice, they have to hide a lot of the forms and a lot of their philosophy under a Christian rubric. And to give you an example, when you participate in a Huichol ceremony, for example, you will see a lot of elements in what we call altars, the kind of way that I was referring to, but in Spanish they're called altars because the church has altars. And so rather than referring it to a central place where you have sacred things, the Kali Way, of course, you call it an altar. And in almost every altar, you will see a Christian cross. And many of the elders will, when they start their ceremony, they will pick up a Christian cross. And they will kiss it and venerate it and do all of those sorts of movements in the traditional way with a Christian cross. Because everyone who's observing is observing to see if, in fact, they are, quote, loyal to whoever the powers that be. And then once they've gone through the process of saying, we've worked with the cross, we're doing all the sacred movements with the cross and so on, even some of the candles that are required or that the elders will ask for their ceremonies will be the wax candles, it's called cirios, that are found in the Catholic Church. So that if the priest arrives and says, okay, what are you guys doing here? Well, we're having a ceremony, and they'll see the cross, and they'll see the Lady of Guadalupe, and they'll see the church candles, and they'll see all of the elements that he expects to see that are consistent with the Catholic Church. Then it's okay, now you can continue with your, I'm sorry, is it most of the time?
Anyway,
we'll continue with the ceremony. If they don't have those elements, they shut the ceremony down. So many people get the mistaken notion when they go to some of these native ceremonies and they see all of these Christian icons. They get the mistaken notion that they've all converted. But this is the only way that the elders are able to transmit the cultural knowledge of the community is by this overlay, Christian overlay. I'll give you again, you see all of the Christ, bleeding Christ, carrying the cross, you know, very, very kind of powerfully bloody Christian icons as you walk in, and so on and so forth. And so when the local elder realized that where we were coming from, that in fact we were working with the Native tradition, then he says, come with me. And he took us to the altar in front of the little church. There's an altar, of course, where the priest does the mass and so on. And they moved the table where the priest would officiate the mass. And under the table, there was this like hidden compartment. And there, you had all of the icons that represented the philosophy of that particular Native community. And so all of the Natives would come to the church and understand that when they were doing their worship for the purpose of the priest and for the purposes of the bishop, and so everybody could see that there was a Catholic program, was a Christian program, then when those priests would leave, then they would pull out their candles and their icons and their elements, their sacred, their staff, their feathers, all of those sorts of things, out of that hidden compartment, put it in the altar or the kaliwe, and then they would have their singing and their dance and their rituals consistent with their true belief system. So Mexico, being the most Catholic country in the world, you will have seen, and there's another chapter in my book where I talk about the visit of Pope John Paul. You get the impression that everyone's Catholic and everyone's with a Christian program. But if you dig a little deeper, you find that while they respect Jesus and the Christian program, because out of their own nature, intrinsic nature, that you respect all other beliefs, still hidden within that worship, you will find that they are carrying those traditions that come from way back and will continue into the future.
Well, I'm glad to see that Hunab Ku is alive and well.
And thriving.
I'm glad to see it. You know, a lot of the same thing went on up here, you know, before the Native American Religious Freedom Act. You know, they did their ceremonies in secret. If they got caught, they went to jail, but they didn't care. And that really gratifies me to hear that. But,
oh, no,
but you know,
absolutely. It's thriving, and they're holding on to the tradition. But they're facing tremendous challenges. And I think one of the things that is worth saying, for those in your audience who may be not familiar, my intention in my book, which was my first attempt, I'm in the middle of a second book now with a great deal more detail, is to say that I'm not trying to put wings on anyone. I'm not saying that Native communities are free of all of the perversity that other human groups are guilty of. No, we have good and bad in everyone, and in many of the Native communities, certainly in the United States and in Mexico, alcoholism is a tremendous problem. Despair is a tremendous problem. Now increasingly drugs are a tremendous problem. And the reason is that you have an unraveling of that traditional system. I mean, think about it. If you are trying to educate your own family, you educate those that come after you, and you're having to hide the way you're educating them because your school system is teaching them something totally different. Your church is teaching them something totally different. The government is organized to brainwash you in a completely different way. The success of you being able to hold on to what you know and to keep your children protected is going to, it's going to have some problems. And there are some communities where, half of the population is in total despair. So this is not to suggest that Natives have some sort of, special gift of being angels, or to suggest there are no problems. The problems are many and severe. The only purpose of my work is to tell people, if you look closely enough at these communities, and if you listen to their elders that are still alive and well today, they have something to say. And whether you agree or you don't agree, or you want them to all disappear, the fact of the matter is they have something to contribute to the general knowledge and philosophy of the world. And so, listen and allow them to express what they have in their hearts. That's all.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keepers interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
Keepers of great wisdom, truth of other times, let the wind blow.
And if it serves you, great. And if it doesn't serve you, well, then you move on and do something else.
Excellent. Well, that you just don't know how good that makes me feel. And I know, you know, things are changing in the church too. I don't know whether you're aware of this or not, but John Paul is now carrier of a sacred pipe and went through a sweat lodge ceremony with some Dakota Sioux when he visited Canada. So attitudes are changing. The liturgy is changing in Africa. They're using more traditional words, actions in the actual liturgy in the church in Africa. Well, maybe things will change more in
John Paul has healed a wound that had been festering in Mexico for 500 years. Mm-hmm. When he visited the Yucatan area, the Mayan area, he made it clear that the church would respect the native traditions, and that was very important. But the primary healing that he accomplished was when he went to Mexico City a couple of years ago and recognized Juan Diego as a saint. And now let me tell you just very briefly the history. Juan Diego, there are many people that say that he's fiction. He never existed. And in fact, I had that conversation with one of the elders, Don Rubén, who's from Nayarit in Mexico this last month. And we talked about that. And he says, well, we know that Juan Diego is fiction. And I said, you know, yes, grandfather, we know historically that Juan Diego is fiction. However, the healing that has occurred among many native people who up to this point had not been validated as having a soul by the Catholic Church. You remember that there was a papal bull that said that Indians did not have souls way back in the 1500s in order to justify their enslavement.
Yes.
Well, now, with the recognition of Juan Diego as a saint, there was an implicit recognition that Indians had souls. That was tremendously healing for the Mexican psyche. And one of the reasons the Mexican people love this pope so much is that this pope came and said, "I recognize that you're valid as human beings in your rituals and ceremonies, and I recognize that your soul in religious terms, healed that tremendous wound that had been festering for so many years in Mexico. And that's why there was this tremendous outpouring of love and sympathy and support for this Pope, and why he's loved so much. Because he has healed that. The Catholic Church has finally come of age and has entered into a partnership that hadn't existed before. And hopefully that tradition that John Paul has begun will continue to move in the direction of the smaller things, like we were talking about a while ago, allowing natives to name their children, allowing natives to set their own spiritual or cosmological destiny. And if the church continues in that vein, then the prophecies of the ancients, which was that we will all return to that consciousness of Jaguar where we are all one, then will come and be fulfilled. And that's the work I think that all of us who work in this area are trying to bring that consciousness back, and the church has gone a long way in helping us to all come together as one.
We certainly thank the Holy Father for his actions, and because it's just the beginning. The attitudes, I'm sure that, you know, there were priests. You know, the whole thing probably got started in the, you know, among the more liberal priests, but changing the mind from the top down is a lot easier from the bottom up.
Oh, absolutely. No, this Pope has been absolutely tremendous, and we have the highest respect and affection for him. Because he has brought healing to Mexico that was sorely needed from the Western point of view. From the other's point of view, it was always there. So it was just kind of like a meeting of that consciousness. And that's why I started off by saying we're very common sense, practical thinking, in the sense that when we say the return of the Jaguar consciousness, what we're saying is we're going back to, and we're coming to again, to that consciousness in which we are all one.
We always knew it. We're just remembering it.
Exactly.
Outstanding. Well, what did the elders say this last visit?
One of the, from a ceremonial standpoint, I will share with you, the elders have asked that all of those who hold altars, and most of us in the native tradition hold altars, hold kaliways, hold sacred spaces, have asked that the seven candles of different colors be burned in those altars, with each prayer going in seven, for the seven continents, but also different colors, to bring back that consciousness that we are all one family and that we are all one flame. And so one of the things that they've asked everyone who is part of this tradition or who is wanting to know of the native tradition to please burn seven different colored candles on your altars or sacred spaces in order to continue to move that thought form forward, that feeling forward that we are all one family. And that is the act of concentration, that is the act of bringing together or of kind of unifying the thinking that has been so divided. And this, one of the things that they've asked as well, is that as this consuming of the candles occurs at the altar, that prayers go out to the four directions, and of course for the healing of the conflict in Iraq, principally, which they see as very important to heal, because they feel that may become very, very severe and just unravel a series of wars in that area. And so they want that peaceful focus toward Iraq. The other thing that is very important to recognize is that the seven, of course, is the four and the three, and numerology is also very important in the cosmology and the way that it sets forth in the community. And all groups are asked to build four-direction lodges, meaning four doors, and that is a practical way, but it is also a metaphorical way of saying that the Temazcal, which is the healing lodge of fire, the grandfathers in the Mizrahi lodge, that they be four-direction lodges, which means that all races, ethnicities, religions, should be invited into those lodges, so that again, it's a reaffirmation of this concept of we are all one family.
Outstanding. Well, I know my Cherokee brothers and sisters are you're speaking their language. And well, you know, it's really interesting. I applaud El Presidente Vicente Fox for his actions and through the through the government of recognizing the Cherokee Nation of Mexico, because that is our homeland. And a lot's happened. I guess the healing, I hope the healing is going on in Chiapas. I know things seem to be changing and changing for the better. Our teacher, Sequoia, who revealed the Cherokee alphabet syllabary many years ago, we knew of the group of Cherokees that left after the Treaty of Holston in 1721 and went to the base of the Rocky Mountains in what is now is the correct pronunciation Coahuila?
Yes, Coahuila.
And just south of the Big Bend area in Mexico. And you know, for many, many years, Cherokees have known that Sequoia, you know, at that time, because of political pressures, he was on the run from the United States government and on the run from the Mexican government. He was very, very ill, and took he was given shelter by a Cherokee family that lived there in the village where our people went to, and died there. And in the ensuing years, many, many Cherokees have gone down there. But until a group showed up in traditional clothing, no one said anything. But a group that lived in southern Texas visited, and they were taken to recognize the Cherokees. They were taken to the hacienda and the cave where Sequoia died. They were told of they were shown artifacts and told prophecies, and a lot of many wonderful things have happened. But you know, it's like my teacher John Red Hat had many friends in the administration of the Cherokee Nation, the seat of which is at Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And he was speaking with a very highly paid police officer who will remain nameless. You can imagine who it might be, though. And he mentioned to this officer, he said, "Well, what do you think of the Cherokee Nation of Mexico?" And the government officer said, "Yeah." He says they sure dress in funny clothes, and he says, "Oh, they still believe in all that herbal stuff," you know. So that shows you how far Cherokees are from themselves. So many have said that you know, our culture was basically over by 1880, but now that the seventh generation has been born since removal and the Trail of Tears, even among families that didn't participate in the Trail of Tears and left long before the Trail of Tears, there is an awakening. And there was also a fourth prophecy a prophecy that when a fourth part of the Cherokee Nation was recognized, that there would begin a healing. So I encourage everybody to visit CherokeeNationMexico.com. And I don't know whether you have yet, but it's fascinating. It talks about Mexico and shows about some of the healing that's going on down there.
There's a tremendous amount of movement now, and a lot of people are recovering their roots or gaining that consciousness, as we put it. We will be having a gathering for people who are interested in Lavida, Colorado, at the Ritter Ranch on June 17th to the 20th.
Outstanding.
It's basically a prayer gathering. We come, and we're all for directions. People come from all over, again, all ethnicities, all religions, all cultures, and we will be sharing some of the messages that come from the elders from Mexico, and some of which I shared with you this evening, and also to just people who maybe are not so familiar or who are looking to recover some of that wisdom. To share with them a little bit of some of the research that we've done. And of course, we have prayers, we have lodges, and sharing of food and ritual and so on and so forth. This is right at the foot of the Oaxaca Mountains in the Mesa Ritter Ranch in Lavida, Colorado, the 17th to the 20th, and everyone certainly is welcome to join us.
Well, you asked the candles be burned, and I was on eBay a couple nights ago, and I noticed an article that was being sold on eBay. That was a figure of seven brothers. I guess it's called the Seven Brothers. It's a handle holder. You may have seen it where everybody's arm in arm.
Right.
Have you seen them?
Yes.
Oh, boy, I'm going to get one of those. Because, you know, seven clans, even though we know, Cherokee felt that we had as many as 80 clans at one time, and maybe more, less anciently 14 clans, but it all boiled down to seven clans, and that's what we celebrate today. And, well, we dance counterclockwise. we're a little bit different, and it's kind of fun to go to a powwow and dance clockwise, and everybody else is going the other way.
You know, it's interesting because, as I said, when you consider just from practical terms, if 80% of your population is decimated, whatever city you live in, whether it's Chicago, Houston, Dallas, or whatever city you live in, and 80% of the people get wiped out by a virus, you're going to lose not only a lot of the institutional information, you're going to your systems, the way that was organized, you're going to lose a lot of it. And one of the things that the elders are very keen on is recovering some of the institutional forms that were existing in the past to revisit them in consciousness in the present and in the future. And for example, the houses, I mean, there's so many houses that were, and I'm talking about families that were working and operating in a particular system, and we only have a few that we know that are active today, not because that was it. There were so many other forms and so many other activities going on, but so much was lost with the advent of smallpox into the continent. So it's a slow process. It's a recovery. You have to dig and find the artifacts, and then you have some crazy people like that Friar de Lanza, who said that all of the books of the Maya were satanic, and he did this huge book burning of all these codices. We only have four in existence today. I was fortunate enough to help Obasan with the Spanish to English translation of the fourth codex. And so you have, so many, so much of the knowledge of the ancients that has been lost, and it has to be recovered. The good news is that because the elders have such a reverence for environment, so much of the information is in the environment, and they've been able to recover a great deal of it, although some of it has been kind of hidden over in some Western forms, and that's all right. The point is that it's being recovered and slowly being transmitted to other people, and for those of your younger audience who are interested in the path of apprenticeship and who are interested in learning the tools of how to recover information from the environment, are more than welcome to join us certainly in June, and we can put them in touch with people and or integrate them into some of the recovery process that we're involved in. We show, for example, vary everything. I mean, you create gourds with various materials, various icons, various candles, and so on and so forth, and they do what we call seeding. Information in the ground. There are some places in Mexico that are just teeming with seedings and burials and so on, that if you're lucky, you can find a place where people have left things from hundreds of years ago, and you can recover these and then learn from them, observe them, and record them.
So
there's a tremendous amount of work to be done, and it's the young people that have to do the work. Those of us like you and me, Blotter, we've been around, we've done what we can do, and now all we can do is just try to mentor and teach, and it's the young people that have to get involved and continue the work so that they get ever more educated and ever more sophisticated and recover that knowledge.
So we see the prophecies being fulfilled, that the ancestors are speaking from the dust. And we also see the Christian prophecy being fulfilled of the restitution of all things as spoken of by all the mouths of all the holy prophets. And the Hopi prophecy being fulfilled that all of the old medicine societies would have a resurgence, even the ones that were long dead, because that information can be had through spirit direct connection with Hunaku, Creator.
Absolutely.
absolutely outstanding. Outstanding.
Let the wind blow. Let the truth be known.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look.
To all mankind again, Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper, oh yeah.
Well, you know, I've been dying to get you on, you know, and the, you know.
I certainly appreciate we have to go through some hoops here and there, but that's life. And I certainly appreciate not only that you've given me the platform and the time, but your own personal effort in making all of these voices from all of these wonderful people available to people on the internet, because whether or not they listen in any given day, you're leaving a record that is so vitally important to the our future. And our future we will face to the extent that we understand our past, and that consciousness of the jaguar is here today, and that you're one of those key elements, key people that are making it available to others, and I thank you for that.
Well, I know when I started this effort, I started it with a partner, and that partner kind of took off in another direction that had to do. It just wasn't going in the manner that we agreed in. It was going more toward you know, being sold. And you know, my idea was, hey, this needs to be available. I wanted the interviews to be available in perpetuity. And you know, when I made that promise, I went, oh my, you know, I'm trusting the Creator, because you know, server space costs money. Well, immediately Creator filled the need. My next person, after the conflict with my original partner, the next person that was interviewed, he said that someone had been trying to get him to get on the radio, because this you know, Robert Goswald is been an author for a very long time. He's also been heavily slandered, as has everyone that's been involved with prophecy. Myself, grandfather Roland Thunder, Sun Bear, Wallace Black Elk, you name it, if they've been involved in talking about prophecy, they have all had mud flung at them, accused of being a sex offense.
That's the nature of the beast.
That's unbelievable. I mean, you know, I used to believe the stuff that was going around about ghost wolf until the same stuff started, bizarre stuff started happening. There's still some guy out there saying I'm a sex offender, you know. It's just, you know, you just got to understand that you just can't believe, it's like Ben Franklin said, you know, well, you know, you believe half of what you see and nothing of what you read.
Right.
And you got to go meet these people, and, so anyway, this friend of Robert Gussel said, well, hey, you know, I happen to have a server, and he said, look, you know, let's do this, you can have the space you need, and unlimited bandwidth, and thanks to Griff, and I don't even know his last name yet. I understand he's also a friend of Red Elk, and thanks to Griff, you know, we're up and running. We've got the space we need, and you know, and as far as, you know, keeping the cable up and running here at the house, you know, taking a few donations, it's just keeping everybody on an even keel, and everybody's getting what they're needing, not maybe what they're wanting, but Creator's really at work here on this show.
Well, absolutely, and I think that one of the things that is important for your listeners is also to understand that when they get involved in trying to do any work in the Native community, recovery work, or even apprenticeships and so on, that part of the damage done by destroying 80% of the population in a historical period in our time, you're always going to have conflicts that seem to be very petty and superfluous. The important thing is just keep focused on what you're doing and don't let others discourage you or others take that positive energy away from you.
Yeah.
Part of learning to be an apprentice, part of learning to do the work is to hold the space of energy within yourself in a good way and recognizing that you are doing this for your grandfathers and your grandmothers. And in doing the work of your own family line, whatever family line that is, and of respecting those that came before you, and of recognizing that you have an obligation, a responsibility, and a love for those that came before you, and that you're leaving this for those that come after you, then it makes all of this nonsense and all of these attacks kind of, almost laughable, because it really doesn't matter what anyone else has to say or what anyone else does. They can say and do whatever they want. Your job is just to hold your space in a good and powerful way.
That's right.
And make your contribution in a good and powerful way for those that come after you. Because your only obligation is to those that came before you. And if you keep that perspective, and you keep your heart in the right place, and you keep your dedication and conviction working in a powerful way, then, as I said, the rest of it, it becomes just a detail and the normal challenges of anyone's everyday life. And even if you do something else, there will always be people who will want to take your good, positive energy away. So don't let it bother you. Yeah. Keep doing the work that you're doing.
It takes a little courage.
It's a tremendous contribution.
It just takes a little courage. And, you know, we find it. And you know, we pray for those that, you know, these people that detract from me and Robert or anybody else, you know, I just say, hey, you know, they're misguided. One of these, they'll either get it or they won't. And you know, the people that, unfortunately, the people that I'm concerned about are the people that are on the fence. And I always say to myself, well, who are they going to believe? Are they going to believe Creator, or are they going to believe this guy over here that's accusing us of this? So it's all in Creator's hands anyway. Well, listen, I wanted to ask you about All Things Common. All Things Common is my bandwagon. It's something that's written about in the Bible. It's something that it was written into an ancient record that was taken out of the ground here in the Americas in 1820. It's Edgar Casey has spoken about All Things Common. He called it the kind of communism that Jesus taught. He says not what they have in Russia, but he said that this was our future. The Urantia book speaks about the all things common, the coming together, the sharing, the caring. It is still alive and well in Mexico. What can we learn from from the people south of the border about caring and sharing?
Well, one of the, I'm going to try to put it in maybe some terms that maybe more relevant or understandable from the American point of view or the Western point of view, but many people believe that freedom is no structure or no order, and it is exactly the opposite of that. In order to accomplish the maximum amount of freedom for everyone, you have to have a maximum amount of order. Rules are absolutely essential in order to maintain a functioning democracy, and in a functioning democracy what you have, of course, is the law. And when people disrespect the law, then you have the unraveling of that democracy. We get away with murder and so on and so forth. So the way that what I mean by that is that it's actually there's no such thing as a right and a left in the kind of Western way of thinking about it. There's only a structure that keeps things together.
The center, the left of the sides may be totalitarianism and anarchy.
They're not really sides. It's only structure.
The middle ground is where everybody meets together and shares with each other.
But that middle ground can only exist if you have a very strong order, and that kind of offends the left, who want kind of the anarchists. I want to do whatever I want. And it offends the right because the right wants to have order, but only people doing what they want. And so it basically is the way that the natives think of it is you have to come to the middle under a very strict structure, which is why you have, in a lot of the ceremonial events, you have guardians. Plato talks about the guardians of the society, and he thinks of it as wise elders. Well, Plato is basically talking in those kind of metaphorical terms and practical terms that the natives think of it, because if you go to a native ceremony, you will find that they have guardians, and these guardians can be guardians of the fire, keepers of the jaguar, keepers of the deer. You have keepers of the entryway. You have a very, very organized and very orderly structure that's set up. Now, within that orderly structure, within that, the reference point would be like the Native American ceremony. Whenever that their ceremony occurs, and you have this very, very strict order, and everything being protected, and everything being guarded, and everything being followed in a very, very precise fashion. Within that structure, healing can happen. And the reason healing happens within that structure is because then any person has safety within which to experience whatever they need to experience. People who sometimes come into the ceremony without being very familiar with it will see people crying, will see people going through all sorts of lunacies, we'll see people kind of losing it, if you will. And they're kind of taken aback by, well, how is this possible? And what they don't understand is that a space is created within the ceremony to allow you to achieve the healing that you need to achieve. Now, this is not so strange. If you look at some of the work that's been done, the archetypes by Carl Jung, where he says that we all have some certain basic forms within our own mind that are projected outward. If you look at some of the work done by Richard Bandler and John Grinder, if you look at some of the work, even Anthony Robbins does some of this work, where he works with people to solve or resolve whatever traumas might be there. There are other work that's been done by that same school, where they call basically a the only way in which someone can go through a healing process is to have a very, very orderly, strict process such that there's a safety in which the person can then go through their healing process.